Rise and shine! It's a great day in the North Woods!
Welcome to the Camp Voyager podcast, unofficially sponsored by the WELK radio show. I'm your host, Alex Quanley. Today, I'm in the director's cabin at camp, so you may hear a few interesting noises. My co-host, John Erdman, is also along for the ride, and we're joined by Brian Helverson and Kyle Emmons, who recently returned from a 415-ish mile paddle from Ely to Minneapolis. Brian and Kyle spend their winters dog sledding at Wintergreen, just upriver from Camp Voyager on White Iron Lake, and they spend their summers here at camp. I wouldn't allow them to share any trip stories until I was in front of them with my mic, so they were just bursting at the seams to share the details from their latest adventure. Enjoy the show.
I'm Brian, and this is
Kyle,
and we work at
Camp Voyager,
and also
Wintergreen Dog Sled Lodge.
John had asked that we play off each other, so I hope you get it.
There we go. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm Kyle. This is my second summer here at Camp Voyager.
Give me your little school background thing. I think that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. I came up to Ely for a program called Wilderness and Park Management at the then Vermilion Community College.
The Boundary Waters College, which I've always thought is interesting, is I think Kyle's our first employee from that school.
Am I really?
Which is really odd that it's right sinking
like
there.
Okay, honestly, I did not know this camp existed when I was at that school.
We're pretty good at hiding out here on Farm Lake.
Yeah, it's very low-key out here.
You would think.
Until it's not, then it just explodes into a huge thing.
Yeah.
Then you just, everything's about Camp Voyager all of a sudden.
So where did the idea for this trip come from?
So I, last winter, was just connecting rivers and stuff. I was plotting out all these rivers I wanted to do around the area.
Fun fact about Kyle, he likes maps.
Oh, I love maps. And water. So these rivers were just going all over the place, and I was thinking, I wonder if we could just connect this to here and see if I could go home, maybe, if that's possible. And I didn't know even about the Savannah Portage. I just found this random river called the Prairie River, which just needed a road portage to get to, nothing historic. But then eventually I found the Savannah Portage, and that was like, oh, well, that's historic. Let's make this trip happen. It sounds kind of fun.
So through this whole time, Kyle and I are working together at the Dog Sled Lodge guiding trips, and Kyle's always just talking my ear off, and I nod and act interested, and he's telling you about some cool route. He's like, I should do this. I want to do this so bad. And at Camp Voyager, anybody who's worked here knows it's really fun to sit around with your coworkers and spit out ideas of this trips we want to do after camp and things and they come to fruition like 10% of the time, and that's generous.
And it's so hard to get a trip like that to happen.
Because usually, real life always comes crashing down on you, right? But in that fun bubble you're talking about it.
People got to go back to work.
So as somebody who's dealt with so many of these things falling through, I just decided to commit to the Kyle. Well, I'm going to do Kyle's silly thing. I didn't actually ever really pay that close attention to what his silly thing was. I had just agreed to do it in this window, basically, of time.
Yeah.
And it became kind of just a joke that Kyle was going to commute home, right? Kyle's commuting back home because he works up north to go home visit and then come back to camp, obviously, to finish his commute. And we just thought it was funny to do it by boat, which is more for the joke, really, than anything.
Yeah.
But turned out to be historic in lots of ways, wildly interesting to me.
Very fun trip.
But, yeah, I mean, this totally a Kyle's baby, though, route-wise and stuff. I'm just the guy that's crazy enough to go with
him. I've spent so many hours just plotting out the actual rivers and how far each river actually is.
So my only requirement was that, so 8 years ago, I did a solo trip. I wanted to go from Itasca to when I lived in St. Paul at the time, to go to my house in St. Paul by canoe from the top. So just on the Mississippi, about a 500-mile chunk. And a lot of stuff went crazy on this solo trip. It was crazy hot and a bunch of things happened, and I had to bail on it a little early. I only had a certain chunk of time off of work at the time between jobs. And so I bailed at Brainerd at that time, 300 miles into the 500 miles. And so I've always kind of gnawed at me that I haven't finished that Brainerd to Minneapolis section of this. Mm-hmm. All right, Kyle, as long as we finish my route and instead of stopping in Coon Rapids, we push all the way to downtown Minneapolis.
And we went all the way down.
Get our picture taken on the Stone Arch Bridge, then I'm in. So
we made it happen.
And it was awesome.
So, yeah, that Mississippi section was 240-ish miles to complete, so
and which is so bizarre
about
because
your whole trip.
By the time we hit the Mississippi, and we're like, the trip is done. Like, it's gonna be over day after tomorrow. It felt like,
and
how
it
many
was.
Days was it?
It was
four or five on the Mississippi.
5 days. At least.
Wow.
And we took we overnighted in Brainerd at a hotel and stuff. The Mississippi with the high water was very fast.
It was very smooth.
And this was an 18-day trip?
18 days. We kind of call it 17. 18
days from camp, but when we tell people about the trip, it's 17 from Ely.
Because there was a whole first day dilemma where we spent the first night at Wintergreen. That's about 5 miles down. It's not really a day.
So by water from camp, Wintergreen's on White Iron Lake. It's about a... So those familiar with camp, you got the Silver Rapids Bridge there, so you can paddle from camp to there in 15-ish minutes, and then usually you can paddle up under the bridge into White Iron Lake, but we were going at ice melt, so it was a raging flow, so we had to land at the bottom of Silver Rapids and portage across the road.
So there was our first portage.
And we got across the road, and suddenly we could see a lot more ice than was there the last 2 days, because there was a full, nice pad. We had a nice, half the lake was open along the shoreline to get to Wintergreen from where we put in over there.
But
and then it was suddenly...
The wind blew all this ice in, and we couldn't go.
We hit a full wall.
We were going to try and go across it, but it was the candle ice, really cool sounding, like crystalline ice. We went through a little bit of it, and then it just got solid. Couldn't go anywhere. So we had to turn around, go back to Silver Rapids, and we trucked our stuff to Wintergreen.
So we had to hike back to camp.
Grab a trailer,
hook it to Kyle's truck, drive the boat to Wintergreen.
Unload, drive it all the way back to camp, and then
so
go back to Wintergreen.
So you didn't technically paddle back from camp.
We got to complete that section. We got
to
go
we
from
to finish
camp to Wintergreen. We should do that this summer.
Yeah, I've actually never done that exact
thing. Neither have I.
So technically the trip did us have a break in it. So we wanted to, obviously, for the CV people start here. But so I guess to our Wintergreen friends, though, we're still... So 17 days from Wintergreen, which is still Ely. And that was the time it took us to get down there.
Yeah.
So, which was the original window I had for my Mississippi trip back in the day.
There you go. Yeah.
And what's our mileage total, Kyle?
Total mileage is 413 miles over 17 days.
And we both realized on the trip that was both of our longest camping trips.
Yeah.
Like consecutive.
My previous one was 11 days. And it was way less miles.
And but, so, give me the overview of the route from Wintergreen.
Overview of the route. Okay, so we started at Camp Voyager, crossed over rapids, went down White Iron.
So Farm Lake to White Iron Lake.
And then we portaged over this, to kind of a forest road, over to Birch Lake. All the way down there.
It's a forest road in the summer. You can drive pretty much all of it, right?
Yeah.
And
it's a snowmobile trail in the winter. So we do that all the time on dog sleds. We know it. And then hit Birch Lake, go all the way down Birch Lake to the south side, and then paddle up the Birch River.
So if you kind of breeze over, that's a 3 mile road portage.
Oh, it is 3 miles. It's
so
no that, short
to Birch Lake. And so Birch Lake. The Kwishwe River there is really wild. There's what we call it Foo Foo Falls at Wintergreen. I don't know if that's on any official map.
After Bunny Foo Foo.
Okay. Yeah. So, but it's a pretty good rapid, but it was a torrent. So we didn't even try. I think normal times you can portage around individual sets of rapids along that 3 mile section, but we didn't even attempt. We just shot down the road.
Yeah.
And Kyle can tell us about his awesome cheaty idea he thought of the night before.
Oh, yeah. So we were all sitting around Wintergreen, and I was thinking, well, we have Sam here. He can just drive some of our stuff over to the other side of the portage, and we'll pick it up as we go by. So
we drove literally all of our stuff and just had our wallets with us and a toothbrush.
Our canoe and
the canoe.
A small, small backpack.
And so Sam McLean, who actually works here at camp.
Shout out to Sam.
She's helping out Deb in the kitchen.
Thanks, Lam.
Sam's a guide with us at Wintergreen, but we paid her dinner and she drove all our stuff out there, so we stashed in the woods. So then we basically portaged, taking turns with the canoe and a tiny little pack. And we borrowed a sleeping bag and crashed at Wintergreen for the night night before.
Yeah, so. That portage flew by with nothing.
Yeah, yeah. So we were on Birch Lake about a mile up when we had lunch.
Yeah,
yeah.
Not even.
We didn't get going
right
crazy
there.
Early, so.
Yeah. So, second portage, yeah. Over the Foo Foo portage.
Then Birch Lake.
Birch Lake, and then up the Birch River. Everything's still
flowing.
Well,
Birch Lake, you kind of, what's Birch Lake?
Birch Lake is, it's like a backflow. There's a dam.
So it's basically a river that's turned into a lake. So big, long, wide, 13-mile-long, skinny, weird lake.
Narrow lake.
It's real close to camp, but I've never paddled it before.
It's very wild. The most of the lake has no houses on it.
Beautiful. Like a BWCA lake for the most
of it. It's got all the rocks, all the outcrops, and big boulders on the shoreline. massive boulders on the shoreline.
And quite a few campsites out there that are gorgeous. I'm thinking potential camp trip this summer, maybe, potential Alex. Potential camp trip,
So way down the Birch River, that's where we spent our first night, was at the end of that first camping night. And then up the Birch River, because everything still flows north up to Hudson Bay at this point.
So this is our first upriver paddling section. Mm-hmm. We just hiked the other upriver
side. Yeah. Let's go over the route and then fill everything else in as we go up, okay. I guess. So up the Birch River, cross this height of land portage over roads to the Embarrassed River, and then we're going downstream. Down the Embarrassed River, through the lake chain near Giant's Ridge, it's a ski resort, all the way down to the St. Louis River, which, as we know, dumps into Lake Superior at Duluth. But before Duluth, there is Floodwood, a small town, and that's where the East Savannah River comes in. And we turned on, off this big, mighty waterway, to a small, little, narrow inflow. So we just turned upstream, and then that was 13 miles over the Savannah Portage, which was 5.5 miles. Right?
Yeah. Lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. And then
it's hard to say what the actual is.
It was hard to say because it was a little wet.
Even with a satellite photo, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, and then over the West Savannah River, and then into Big Sandy, Mississippi, all the way down to St. Anthony Falls.
Wow. Okay.
There's a lot of rivers in there.
Before the show, you guys kept talking about this historic route, and I think most people are, well, not most, but most paddlers are familiar with the Voyager's Highway from International Falls to Lake Superior, and the Voyager's, some of the renowned lakes like Knife Lake and the Grand Portage itself, but you guys keep calling this route historic, so can you tell me a little more about that?
Well, the Voyagers ended up, you know, they had business as far south as the Twin Cities as well, especially later on in the fur trading era. So they paddled the Mississippi as well, all the way down to there. So they had to also do what we did. Kind of the significant part geologically of this whole trip is that you're crossing two continental divides, thus the giant portages that have to happen to make that happen. So, you know, going from Ely down south, first you got the Laurentian Divide, which divides water draining basically up to the Arctic Ocean through Hudson Bay, or water going south of us. And then that water either splits on this other divide towards Lake Superior or towards the Mississippi River. So you have those two spots where you have to cross these divides where rivers, there's no waterway to connect these things, so there has to be a walking area. And so, you know, these things, over time, like animals will naturally develop paths. The same way, you know, portages are kind of always found. A lot of them were done by native people, too, and animals. And these paths kind of naturally form where you get these slips between these watersheds like this. And so, you know, probably, you know, in the Savannah Portage area, it was probably traveled by animals and early people here and there.
Absolutely.
And then once the Northwest Company and these big businesses found out about this, and this is the place to cross. It's the easiest place.
They make it
place.
Their business to make it passable.
Yeah. So, but this one had a reputation amongst the Voyageurs in this period of being the worst portage.
Like, worse than Grand Portage.
Yeah. Grand Portage is longer, but this one is, you know, it's hell swamp. It is, I mean, the first, you know, at their time when they were doing it, it was probably, you know, a mile or so, mile and a half of just
about
would
six,
have been swamp.
Six and a half miles. Because
those channels weren't even there. The first mile and a half of that probably would have been wet. So, I mean, they probably built stuff with throwing logs down and rudimentary things. But
they did.
That, nothing's worse than carrying heavy weight through that. And then there is a little tiny, you know, an Oak Savannah Ridge. That, you know, where you actually drive for the last five-ish or so miles, 4.5 to 5 miles.
Mm-hmm. Probably 4.5 miles.
It's actually a really pretty spot, and there's some historical stuff. There's actually a fairly big battle between a couple tribes there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't know. Jump in here, Kyle. What else? What else?
It just jumps this divide. And from the two rivers, the East Savannah and the West Savannah, they're not connected, but they have similar names. It's a 100-foot rise. That's all it is.
So it's real low. So this is a real low place to cross this divide, obviously.
So it just made the most sense
lowest,
to cross
flattest.
It there. With the most dryish land to cross over. So,
but the east and west Savannah rivers are not big rivers. So imagining those and those long, you know, birch bark canoes with the amount of dams and
you got all these dams to go over.
Fallen
it's
trees
narrow.
And things.
It's shallow.
It's
so you got to drag your canoe. You got to go over obstacles and small, tiny little rapids to work around.
So I'm sure just like us, it is a major relief when you hit Big Sandy Lake and you hit that 4 miles of open water and then an easy entry into this little river, bam, you're on the Mississippi. And
there was
flying
a rendezvous point on the Big Sandy Lake. So I'm sure they had their massive parties whenever they got over across that divide. But yeah, big time for celebration there on Big Sandy Lake. And right at the end of that lake, it dumps into the Mississippi. And that's where our highway really started.
Yeah. And then like we said, the Mississippi's a blink and you miss it kind of thing. But for us, the Mississippi was more the kind of coming together of the sped up spring we experienced.
Yeah, accelerated spring, as Brian put it a lot.
So we started this trip, obviously hitting an ice wall, right?
It was ice in Camp Bay right out here.
Yep.
Right out,
and there was snow still here in camp when we put the
boat in the water. There was snow on Giant's Ridge as we passed by the ski resort. There was still snow there.
So then we're heading south, but in time 17 days later in the Twin Cities, it was as fully leafed out and days of 80 some degrees.
So hot
and,
when we were paddling.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Green, one of the most beautiful green luscious. So then by the time we were at St. Cloud, it was full on beautiful luscious green spring. And that's actually maybe the most pretty section of anything.
That spot between Brainerd and St. Cloud, I think.
I think just South of St. Cloud is my favorite. But
South
of St.
Cloud?
All of
I like
was...
the spot between Brainerd and St. Cloud. That was beautiful.
Okay, so my vision of the mighty Mississippi is kind of a urban, muddy.
Because you're only seeing that the
muddy,
bridges.
Yes, but
those bridges come, you know, two or three a day, right? But all the time between the bridges, you hardly see anybody. There's
all the
a
houses
couple
are
of
all
places
tucked
with
up
houses,
away.
But most of them, it's like you've got maybe a house every. I mean, it's real rural, and the people that are living along. I mean, we didn't see other boats this whole time, essentially. Basically just lakes we saw.
Once we got by St. Cloud, you see a lot more of those big houses with their nice
lawns. Well, we hit St. Cloud on the weekend before Memorial Day in the 80s.
Fishing opener has been open for a week
weekend.
Now.
Yeah, so.
So everyone's going to be out. We saw so many people that day. We went past through St. Cloud.
But really, it was a surprise. I mean, you didn't see anybody previous to that.
We didn't see any other canoeists going on our entire trip. The whole way. We saw some kayakers out just for little day trips and
nobody
stuff. But no one really traveling the way we were going.
I've done some trips before, and it seems like the people that you meet usually are some of the things you remember the most. Did you guys run into any characters?
Oh, we did. You know Phil, right? Felipe?
Yeah.
So we met a guy who is the spitting image of Phil, but on Mississippi. No, St. Louis.
St. Louis.
No,
we call him Casco Phil.
Casco Phil. So we were at a site called Casco. It was near a small little township. And this guy, we got to camp, we kind of started setting up, and this ATV comes rolling in off of the toilet trail. And didn't know who it was, and he came over, and he stepped off, and he immediately started talking about, oh, I've never seen anybody down here camping, but I'm going fishing right now, and talking about all of his buddies that come by fishing, and just talking like Phil. He looks like Phil. Phil, if you're listening, we got a friend for you.
It was kind of weird. It was like, we both looked, we met eyes, and like, we both, like, mouthed, Phil? It was very bizarre. It's like Phil's long lost brother. Maybe he knows him. I don't know. But it's
I doubt
it's
it. But
like,
yeah,
I've never met a guy so much like another guy. It was really funny to me. Other characters though. So on the West Savannah River, we ran into a guy who's got a farm along the way there. His name was Jake. His Finwegian Farms or something like that. It's like a combination of a couple. Or Scandinavian or something. A combination of a couple Norwegian-y sounding things.
Yeah.
But looked like a pretty big maple syrup operation going on and some other stuff. So
going across the river.
I meant to go look up his website. But he was really interested in our story.
Like
he talked our ear off. He chased us down to the next bridge.
His dogs
you know,
were barking
at us. You know, he's just like, hey, can I help you guys out? You guys need food?
Can I get a picture of you guys?
Yeah. A couple folks asked for pictures of
just
us.
Just a couple.
Then you'd see, you run into people like a nice couple on a pontoon that, you know, they go by slow and then
you see them
kind of turn around and come back and like, they want to talk to you. And they'd be like, hey, how well do you know the river? You get the whole story and then they'll give you like tips like, you know, stick to the left here because the current's going to be better for you, blah, blah, blah. So
offering your water, offering your beer.
You don't see a ton of people, especially in northern Texas. We didn't see lots of people for a lot of the time. Other than, you could talk about our second big portage, our 4 mile road portage.
So,
across the Laurentian Divide.
Once we went up the Birch River, 13 miles, at the end of this day, we get out.
Well, I want to back up real quick. Birch River, right?
Birch River.
Uphill. Uphill, rapids, snowbelt, okay?
We first get there, and there's rapids at the very base of the river where it dumps into Birch Lake. And we're like, oh,
and
no.
They just
the
keep
whole
going.
Thing's
going to
be
just keep
rapids
going
the
as
whole
far
way
as we can
and
go.
Just fast water. It's going to be hard to get up this
But what
thing.
Was the last thing I packed, Kyle, before we
you
left
You packed
camp?
Two wetsuit bottoms.
I
was perfect.
I went
it
and dumped
so
through
good.
The kayaking stuff, grabbed two wetsuit bottoms, and that was clutch because we were basically chest deep in water all morning pulling mm-hmm. up rapids for a chunk.
Just
and
for it, about an hour.
Yeah,
really.
And then we got past it, but...
We made
For that
one,
section, that was such a clutch thing.
We made one very small bushwhack portage because there was some, you know, higher rapids that we had to go around.
That you couldn't, yeah.
But after that, we pulled up a little bit farther and hopped back in, and then it was just a beautiful, calm, steady flow down, so it was easy to paddle against it, winding through this awesome low riverbed.
Some big, wide wetland sections, and then would shrink back down. And
towards the end of it, getting near our putout point,
ran a couple weird bridges.
Kind of weird.
A lot of fun old junk too on these old rivers that go through these little like old, you know, lots of old cars from the,
when you get towards yeah. Babbitt and the Barris, you get more farmland, right? So there's more old forgotten farm vehicles and equipment and bridges.
Like every house in the Barris River along the river, they have a vehicle that's old and rusty.
A chair.
There's one thing. They have at least one rusty old chair or broken chair. They have it's at least partially
stories,
submerged in mud.
We got
they all have
things.
At least one RV and they all have a grill. Those really? Things are, you need those things to be a river house, and 90% of them have those things. And so we'd be looking for it like, God, I don't see the RV here. It's kind of weird, right? He's like, yeah. And they're like,
oh,
and
wait,
just pack there.
Out.
And then
there's
they actually have two of them.
They actually have two.
So like,
doubles of the RV.
Yep. Two RVs. Okay.
Yep.
It was just funny. And they actually had this whole thing. The amount of chairs along the Mississippi is so bizarre. And like
we made up great stories.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, you'll just be paddling along. You haven't seen a house or anything man-made for hour, and then it'll just be, you know, three rusty folding chairs kind of on a little rock, and then you go on, you know, and someone's like partially sunk into the mud, and you're like, who sat, there's no visible trail, who sits on those chairs?
So we came up with this thing about these chairs. They grow from
That's
the riverbanks.
Where they're born.
That's where they're born. They emerge from the mud all gross
and, then
and
they,
rusty.
They eventually become shiny.
And then they
and
get
then
better.
Harvested.
They get shiny. People come by and harvest them, and that's why they have.
So this was an
porches.
Ongoing joke, and it kept getting. By the end, we saw office chairs, we saw directors' chairs, we saw couches,
we saw
any kind of chair seat. Was at some point.
We saw
along
a this. Weightlifting bench.
Yeah, weight benches.
The
any
whole
kind of chair.
Nine yards. It was all there.
Yeah, yeah, all the kinds of chairs.
Bar stools.
Yep,
the whole thing.
Yep. And the other river garbage is abandoned boats. So if you got a motorboat, you chisel off your registration and just dump
you
it
just
somewhere
dump
along
it.
The Birch River. Nobody's going to care.
There's a couple on the Embarrass River.
You'll see, like, it's, you know, maybe it expired. You know, the last registration was, like, 2008, but all the information is chiseled off, and there's a speedboat just sitting on, jammed off to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of them.
It's like a Viking funeral.
Yeah. The Embarrass River and the Birch River is full of this old junk. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Just a dump.
There was two more people we saw on trail. Actually, our friends, Ellen and Tina, from Wintergreen. So when we came up the Birch River, we stopped at Ellen's house. It was right there on our path of the portage, like the exact route we were going to go, pass right by their houses. So we let them know we were going to be passing by. So we pulled out at Ellen's house.
Unfortunately, Ellen was
she wasn't
out of
home.
Town. She was down in Indiana visiting friends.
She knew we were coming, but we didn't know if she was trying to get back up. We exploded our stuff onto her lawn. We had lunch. We dried out some things. And started eating, and then she pulled up, kind of to our surprise, and she had some pastries from the cities, and she was like, oh, I thought I'd miss you guys.
Super excited to see
you. I have some food inside, I think, if you want it.
But the most important part of having Ellen there was
she got to drive our stuff, some of our things, across this 4-mile
portage. We agreed that it didn't break our rules to take one trip by car across this 4-mile portage.
As long as we carried something across this portage, it'd be okay.
And we took the two heavier
things. Take a paddle.
Took our heaviest pack and the canoe width. We carried the two heaviest. But we did take the... So we didn't have to double
trip
it. You
guys' arbitrary rules.
We had to make some sort
we
of
had to
rule.
Think about the rule. Well, we hadn't thought about the
It'd
rules.
It'd be too easy.
Ellen
to say,
just asked
oh,
us. She said, what are your rules? I could drive stuff. And
It'd be
we
too
thought
easy
about
just
it.
To say, yeah, take it all across. That's too easy. Come on.
But it was,
we had to
it
do
was,
it all. We had to walk it, right?
It actually would have taken us... Either we would have had to continue the portage until 10 or 11 p.m.
Would have been a very late
or
day.
Or it would have been in a second day portage, or doing a 2-day portage. And so it was really clutch. The road portage ended up being pretty miserable.
Yeah.
You know, the sheriff drove by at one point and doubled back around. It's like, did this like weird double take because we were like halfway between the two rivers. So nowhere near any body of water. We're just walking along a paved road in the middle of Babbitt. And he's like, even for Babbitt, that's a little weird. So he had to stop.
Yeah.
did the old double take, and he's like, "He's like, you guys break down or something?" All confused. And we're like,
"No, this is our report.
This is normal.
We're just commuting home to Minneapolis.
We're just going places, going home." Yeah,
a lot of odd looks in a few spots like that. But
so Ellen and then Tina eventually joined us. They actually walked with us across the portage, so that was kind of a nice.
So we got friends to chat with for us during our walk, and actually Tina. So Christina, another guide at Wintergreen, she lives basically 3 miles into the 4 mile portage. We walk right by her house, and she had us reroute slightly, just one block over, just because
she has
some
dogs.
The neighbors have some dogs that might chase us. So like, you know, it was nice to have some good insider info on that. But then that night we basically. We ended up at a culvert.
It was getting a little later in the day.
Embarrass River, kind of just along a dirt road past the farm. And
we knew
and
we
the
kept
sun
going.
Is getting real low. And we're looking at the map and it's all...
just wet. Everything would just be wet. There's no dry land to camp on this Embarrass River for miles. So we're like, oh, well, we'll just set up here in the culvert. So in we just pull out...
we're at next to the culvert. There's really no place to go that's like... Not on the side of the road. Yeah, so we're like...
random patch of wet woods off to the side. Like, we're like, well, I guess we'll just hammock here tonight.
We hammocked in a swamp that night.
But we had to cross the...
You had to walk... You had to get your feet... You had to literally get your feet wet. You had to get, like, knee-deep into muck just to get to our camping spot.
The ditch right there. We had to cross the ditch, and had to get
And that was the
wet.
First night we experienced the mosquitoes. Oh, and we realized that we had brought bug spray because it was winter when we left 4 days early. And the mosquitoes were vicious, and we were in a swamp hanging from the trees.
I didn't have a bug net.
and hammocking at those temperatures is a little bit...
Yeah, it was cold that
night. It was a cold
night
in that swamp. Yeah.
Oh, man.
But we were fired up to get going on that Embarrassed River.
We were eating dinner on like the edge of the culvert overlooking the river. There was nowhere to cook, so we had to go cook on the ditch.
That was fun. When Kyle had left something at Christina's house, so she stopped by again and dropped it off.
Oh, my water bottle. Yeah. I had a backup, but...
But yeah, she stopped by to chat with us. It was nice to hang. We're hanging outside the road with... I brought my little folding chair. We're just hanging
out. And cribbage. We played
cribbage
a little bit.
Cooking and playing cribbage along the culvert. And a couple people drove by to kind of give you a funny look. But
yeah, a school bus came by.
We made sure that all of our camping stuff was all hidden back in the woods. Nobody really saw that we were sleeping right next to this little spot on the road. Yeah. But that was probably a worse camp.
That was pretty
bad. Where
else
did you guys stay? Were there designated campsites?
So the first night on Birch was a full-on B-dub style campsite.
You got the fire grate. You got a clear open spot.
That was our best site.
Rock landing.
But my worst night because my tent flooded, the worst I've ever seen.
It was a random thunderstorm
in
the morning that just hit us so hard. His whole tent, sleeping bag was soaked.
Night one, completely wet.
So that's why we were drying our stuff out at Ellen's house later on. Because everything was just soaked. Yeah,
completely wet sleeping bag.
But then after that storm came, it was just glass on the water, and it was so still. It was amazing.
And it basically rained a little bit another day, and that's it.
Yeah, two solid days of rain. Besides that, it was beautiful.
But on the Embarrassed River, that's when the wildlife kicked off. Lots of wetlands, and we're going downstream now, and we saw...
Same kind of terrain as the Birch River, where it was just a wide, flat thing. So all this waterfowl and a moose was walking
Kyle's
off to the side.
Kyle's first moose!
I saw a moose!
It was a big one. My first in 10 years at least, I think.
And you just sit there very quietly. You just hear him crashing through the woods. Moving real slow.
Very good sized moose, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little
very
pale
blurry,
looking, but...
Got a very blurry video.
But unfortunately, it's one of those, you know, they call them the ghost moose that you can tell it kind of been rubbing its sides because of the tick, its tick load right now was really high, so they rub all their fur off and they get sickly and, you know, they literally lose enough blood volume that they're anemic, so they're just weak and, it's rough. But this one looked pretty strong.
It didn't act very sickly.
It just was a little pale.
Yeah.
But
we saw the moose,
we
saw a deer, we scared up a deer, and then it ran up to this bend in the river and jumped into the river out of our sight. We can just hear it thrashing in the water, trying to get across, and then on the other side, post-holing through the muck, trying to get away.
In a complete panic, like, we're not
going to hurt you, dude.
Take your time.
We're just cruising by. All a bunch of ducks, a whole lot of swans.
Yeah, both swans.
And
geese. Swans,
of course, there's all these geese. But they always seem to see you fly about 100 yards up and then wait for you to come back. And then they'll just do it again over and over again for miles.
You can chase the same goose for 10 miles sometimes if it's dumb enough.
We did. We called him Gary.
Gary. Yeah, about Gary.
Gary the goose. We followed him for like a solid 10 miles.
We had a whole backstory for Gary.
On the Embarrassed River. That was...
But you did ask about the campsites. So
Is it private land?
Or, yeah. Like, so the Embarrass and the Birch River, not really.
There's no.
They're not really traveled. They're nothing designated. It's not. So what? Some rivers in Minnesota are designated state water trails.
Yes.
And those the DNR arranges for campsites to be there.
DNR has campsites. They have maps that show the river miles and all the stops along them. Embarrass and the so Birch River.
These
have
campsites
nothing.
Similar to Boundary Waters have like a fire grate situation similar to a Boundary Waters site and a latrine similar, but they all have a picnic table as well.
On the St. Louis, Mississippi.
But unlike the Boundary Waters, these are mostly barely used. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you can't even find them. Or like the one where we met Casco Phil, he said that jerk down the river with the pontoon boat, he stole it last year.
Stole a fire grate.
He used to have a nice fire grate here.
He's all mad about it because he used to cook fish there or whatever and cook meals. Yeah.
So, I mean, with my experience in the Mississippi a few years ago, the same thing. You can't find them sometimes, or they've moved or they're broken and they're just completely overgrown with weeds.
So we had the one campsite on the culvert. Where was the other campsite where we weren't at a true campsite? Where was that? There was one more spot, wasn't there?
Yeah,
on the Embarrass River. We parked on the side of this forest road, up on this bank on an oxbow. Four wheelers came.
And then we actually did it again later, actually just outside of the town of Floodwood too, on the West Savannah. A few times you make bushwhack on public land or some big rancher's edge of his property that
the very very edge. Don't
mind. Everybody you do run into is always excited and So the times that I have, we didn't have this trip, but like on the Mississippi trip before, if you need to camp in somebody's yard, you've mentioned this before, Alex, on your biking trips, people
are nice.
Once you've met them and you've talked to your story, they want you to stay in their yard. You're like a prize.
Yeah, exactly.
They want to show you off to the neighbors.
Exactly.
They call their cousin over to come say hi. Uh-huh. Yeah. So we didn't quite have that just because it was weirdly remote for being a front country trip, mm-hmm. but it's always that possibility's there. Mm-hmm. And so people are always friendly. So even if you are camping in a place that you probably shouldn't ask, better to say sorry and ask permission, blah, 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 but people are going to be cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're not up to no good. And we move on early. We're out of there by 6 a.m. every day.
Were you?
Not quite. But
we'll go over our morning routine. Let's go over that real quick.
Okay, Kyle gets up at 6 a.m.
6 a.m. every morning. All right. And then I'll do something in my tent. Like maybe I'll put away my sleeping bag. And then I'll be like, hey, Brian.
What?
You up? Yeah.
I have been for hours, but I'm not getting up for 10 more minutes, no matter what you tell me to do.
So then I get up, I pack up my tent, and I'm all done packing my tent by like 6:15, and then I get up, and Brian's just getting out of bed, and he's starting to pack up his sleeping bag.
Scratching his legs and staring
at his face. And Kyle's just showing up. All he's doing is showing up. You don't have to pack up in 15 minutes. It's silly.
I'm just set up,
take a break. We were on vacation.
So then by 6:30, I got like probably water going or something for breakfast.
Kyle cooked all the breakfast.
I just had the water going, and then we just oatmeal or leftovers or whatever. We had pancakes one morning. That was good.
That was the one good morning. We had noticed that Camp Voyager, we were packing up some stuff that we were borrowing from packs and things. We noticed that there was a lot of leftover oatmeal from last year. So we brought some oatmeal, and we had oatmeal for literally every breakfast.
15 out of the 17 breakfasts.
And Brian barely tolerates oatmeal. So I think I had it like 3 or 4 days, and I just couldn't do it.
We had like half a bag of brown sugar that we ate.
So like I'd eat like leftover noodles from the night before.
Remember when we started out with dates? We had dates to add to our oatmeal. Then we ran out and never got more.
A lot of fixes. It was good.
Yeah.
So, but there's only
and then
so
by
much
7 by 7:30 we're starting to consider getting out of camp, and then usually we're always out before 8 o'clock.
We're all up by 8.
Yeah, starting to paddle.
Even if Kyle had to sit and wait for me to pack up my folding chair and my tent and all. Kyle had packed
chair?
A very different.
He brought a chair. It was a very nice chair.
I've never packed so much for a trip. It's complicated to pack for a trip in which you're starting in winter, moving to summer.
You gotta prepare for all the things. He brought two sleeping bags.
Never really traveled. Right? Yeah, he had winter bag and summer bag. I had to be able to sleep in a place without a tent pad, so we had hammocks. And
we brought
also
the wetsuit bottoms. We didn't use them for over half the trip.
So we just had to have a fair amount of stuff.
You don't need the entire time, right?
You guys were able to single
no,
trip.
We double
trip.
We
had double trip.
Everything.
You can't double pack.
I mean, we could single trip
packs.
Like over at
for five
a
miles.
Dam. Yeah.
All of our portages were huge. There's no way you're taking two things across in one go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we just don't think of the dams as portages. Like,
oh, the dams?
We would single trip a portage a dam here and there, but
yeah,
it's just not necessary. It's also easier to go back for a second trip rather than hurt yourself.
Yeah. You can make plenty of miles on rivers. Like, you go from 2 to 3, maybe 4 miles an hour without current, and then easily 4 miles an hour with current if you're not paddling. So it's way faster. I think we did 6 miles an hour is like our fastest, just consistent pace we had.
Well, no, we definitely kept. There was like chunks of like the entire Aiken Flood Diversion Channel. We definitely.
Oh, the Aiken one, absolutely. That was like
there were definitely sections we maintained 7 or 8 for hour or two kind of thing. But
a lot of flow with this ice melt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the first thing I asked Kyle, well, one of the first things is when he got back to camp was I was glad that you guys rode in the same car back to camp together because you guys spent so much time together. How did that go? How was your group dynamics? So you guys get into any arguments?
It was great.
Arguments?
All up until about, what, day 15?
Well,
15?
I guess to give perspective on the two of our personalities is Kyle and I are both about as chill people as we get, so we don't
argue. I don't really argue that.
Yeah, we kind of go with the flow. So we both match really well that way, but even us, I guess, do have a limit, because I think our limit, what, day 15?
Day
15, the argument's over, nothing started.
picnic, something, campsite, and then we go buy something, and then we look back, and there's a lot of flow coming out, and then Brian says, oh, that must be from behind the island. And I go, no.
No, I said from the top of... Okay, so from the top of that... Remember, there was that mile of backflow water.
The mile that started before our campsite.
Yeah, and it said that's where it started.
Well, that's not what I saw. We saw two different things, or we weren't looking at the same thing.
And we're still arguing about this, because I don't even know what he's saying. I just know what's wrong.
Because after we left the campsite, there was a little bit that went in, a lot of flow I saw, and then it came shooting out the other side. And he's like, oh, that came from way back there.
No, some of the flow... But then you kept saying that... Okay, I'm not going
to... We're not going to get into it again.
Sorry I brought it up.
So that was...
It's still sore, but I'm also not sure what the argument is. Yeah, if you were to ask me to define it, I don't understand his side. He doesn't understand
mine. I don't get his side at all. It doesn't make any sense.
It's just about where the flow is coming from.
No, it's not even about that. It's that he doesn't know rivers.
You don't know rivers, man. You weren't paying attention that morning.
That's what the argument built up to. I screamed at him, Kyle, all I know is you don't know rivers.
I'm just sitting there trying to keep myself cool.
What are we... Like, we've been... Together on rivers of sand. Yeah, oh, this man. Is so funny.
And then the next day, we were leaving our campsite, and then...
Okay, was there some tension in the morning?
No. It was fine.
The mornings actually are all good.
They're like...
Was there tension that night?
We always... The joke is still that Kyle's showing off in the morning by trying to set records for packing again.
I'm not. Just packing. Yeah.
So you guys got over it, except when someone brings it up.
Usually like an hour later, we're fine. Like, we're just going again, just whatever. But then it'll come up later in the day, and we'll have a little spat about it. Yeah. The next day we were arguing because we didn't notice that we campsite, and then the flow was going one way, and then there was more flow over here. And then Brian's like, let's just go over there. I'm like, that's upstream. Why would we go upstream?
Well, that's what it was.
Yeah. And then
Kyle got mad at me because I wanted to go the route with the better downstream.
I'm going this way. I'm like, okay, fine.
So here's the issue that we have.
Tiny little things that don't make any difference and doesn't matter, but you just gotta go with one person's thing sometimes. And I was like, okay, Brian, whatever, we'll do it.
Well, it's a classic issue when you go on trips with guides. Because as a guide, you're used to being
in control,
the final say on anything.
You are like...
And so then, especially when you throw more than even just two of us. Like, when we went on a ski trip with 12 Wintergreen guides up to the polar bear capital of the world last year, Churchill. It was the same thing. It's like you suddenly have 12 people who are professional guides all winter skiing, and now we're skiing together.
Too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yep.
Cooks in the kitchen.
And then, of course, everyone, you know, we have our boss with us, too. And there's that whole fun dynamic, because he needs to be the king of all of us. And, you know, this is just this whole, I mean, a bunch of guides fighting for... Yeah. It is really hard to just let yourself set back and let them do it wrong. Yeah. But Kyle and I do actually.
Wrong to you.
We've been working really close together for like a year and a half now straight, and we do mesh really good.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine somebody else wanting to do this.
I could not picture anyone else doing this. You were my number one pick because you're the only person crazy enough to do it.
Exactly. We have similar interests in that.
Yes.
But we do at the end of the nights. We would often, our tents were often set up pretty far. And we might 6:30 after dinner just not to talk to each other again.
Yeah.
So, you know, you still... You know, you need space, too. But
no, the sun's still up. I'm going to bed.
Played a lot of cribbage and stuff and talk at night.
Yeah. Which you did win the official cribbage count at the end.
Yeah, we
I think I won all of one game out of the four.
I skunked him the first two in a row.
Yeah. So mad. No, the second game you didn't skunk me because I was ahead by one point.
See, look at all these exciting stories.
We actually had a cribbage count in our journal in the first few days.
Let's bring us back on the rail.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you guys got along pretty well for spending that much time together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What you got in that journal?
So, we started the daily journal, and I think we did miss the last 2 days. I don't think we did that.
Yeah, so we kind of talked before this trip about how we'd never kept a trip journal on anything.
And this seems like the kind of trip where you want to keep one.
Yeah.
So,
and because we've been at Wintergreen, we've been spending a lot of time with some of these guys that do these really big expeditions, like our boss over there, Paul Shirky's, you know, mm-hmm. North Pole and mm-hmm. all these things. And he's written books and stuff, so, you know, there's all these journal entries that they're doing. It's like, all these guys on these trips are always writing journals. Why am I not doing that?
Yeah.
I know in the past we've tried to get campers to do it, but I've never been good about it. So Kyle and I were both the same way, and we decided to hold each other accountable by just going every other day.
Each night we would trade off on who's doing it, and we just write, like, K or B at the end of it so we can keep track.
But we would just next. Let the one person just on their own just decide to do that days. You know, so night
on Birch Lake, we said, all right, we need a name for this journal. It's Toby's Journal. But now it says Toby's Journal. It's not Toby's. It's just Toby.
No, Kyle. I wrote it wrong. Okay, right? This is an art. I said, Kyle said, what do we call this journal? And I said, oh, I call it Toby. And he just wrote Toby's Journal.
It's not Toby's Journal. Thinking, I just wrote
you
Toby's
said the journal.
Journal
is Toby.
The journal is Toby. It's not. Doesn't belong to Toby.
Oh my God. Sorry, the first argument of the trip actually.
That was actually the first.
So there was a few more arguments.
I'm sure there was one. That's the last one in there. Yeah.
Okay. So. Well, that'll be fun to look at.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially after you've forgotten everything.
we brought it, but we didn't look at it all here. But yeah, if we flip through it right now, I mean, there's things.
We have all the way up to day.
There's always stories where you're missing when you're telling these things. But
yeah, all the way up to day 16 in here.
Nice.
Yeah. Starting from Wintergreen. Or Camp Voyager. I talked about the ice wall the first day.
But it is magical the way the journal does when you're writing at the end of the day, just the discussion is like, oh, Kyle, do you remember this thing? And then you just, it's fun discussion. So
yeah, mm-hmm. you're just talking about
I definitely advocate for, and I'll do that for my coworkers this summer, just all these, write a journal at the end of the day. Have your campers help you, you know, get the kids involved. I know we're out trying to get kids to keep a journal.
It helps you with your trip stories.
It really are, but if you're doing
it really does.
But yeah, I think we're going to cherish this thing forever. It's really cool.
For a long time.
So one of the best things I like about trips is kind of the time to think.
Yeah.
Were there any big revelations or epiphanies or transformations or what were some of the big lessons you guys learned about yourselves or each other?
Well, on the topic of learning, I just did something I've never really done canoeing for, because usually in the Boundary Waters wilderness
you want to be
things
where
you want to be quiet and stuff.
We brought a speaker.
We brought a big speaker and just listened to podcasts for a couple
Brian
hours a day.
Brian introduced me to a bunch of new podcasts.
So I'm really into Science
Radio Lab, 20,000 Hertz. I learned a lot on this trip.
How about the Camp Voyager podcast?
He did not mention that one, and I did not remember.
Wow.
I have to admit, I did know this existed, but Alex never advertised it very well to me. I'm not a social media guy, so I miss out on some things unless somebody forces it on me.
It's been more of a soft release.
Boy, I remember, didn't John Bergman do these years and years ago? Is this related or is this a different podcast?
Yeah, him and Peter did.
Yeah, him and Peter Grudewald were doing.
Mm.
But this is a different podcast?
Yeah.
Not connected?
No.
That was Mark 1. What was the name of that podcast?
That was just WLK radio show, I think they called it, or WLK podcast or something.
Huh.
Okay. But, yeah, I mean, so, like, I knew that because I still had never even, and like I said, I'm a big podcast guy. I guess I let us all down. But it was fun, so let's say that we actually just would learn. We just listen to science podcasts and get smarter and then have fun science discussions about
learned all about things and so you forests just, up in trees.
Yeah.
You just consumed information.
Yeah.
Well, and then we'd discuss it, though.
We'd discuss a lot.
And then we actually came up with a few silly theories.
All you could do on that trip was just listen, discuss, and either be quiet. I don't know.
Yeah.
Not many options for this trip. The entertainment in the boat.
I mean, it's definitely more pure paddling time than your average, because of river and not all the portages, compared to a Boundary Waters trip. Just a lot of just sitting and paddling. So it did make the hours fly by in a different way. Because the river can be very much same until it's not. So it's not always something dramatic to look at, but there's often dramatic. Yeah. But then there's punctuated by...
I guess I learned
meditative.
That I usually don't like sitting in the bow. I like to be in the back and control what's happening with the boat.
Well, actually, that's what we learned. Actually, Kyle...
I am a bow.
Likes
the
bow.
I like the bow. I do like the bow.
Which was really good, because again, our two guys fighting, I hated the bow. I have a hard time being in the bow, so... what ended up being is that Kyle would be in the bow, but then he would also though decide where we were going to go and try to outsteer me from the bow. So I had to also accept
a lot of front steering
that he was going to front steer me a lot, and I didn't really have a choice of where we went because he could outrule me,
especially especially on like the bends in the rivers and like all that stuff.
And also, I've learned that Kyle really likes a cross bow draw. Oh man!
Oh dude, it is a fun.
He suddenly got really into it one day and was like just doing it unnecessarily anytime he could. Just like you feel it so. You do feel cool with a crossbow draw.
You sure do. It's,
I think my favorite paddling stroke as well.
Oh yeah,
it's a. It is actually. It is can be fun to because as a Camp Voyager counselor, you don't often get a lot of bow time.
You're usually in the stern all the time.
But there is a lot. There's a lot for a bow paddler to be doing. So don't let anybody tell you it's boring,
especially on rivers. You're looking out for rocks. Mm-hmm.
But you are steering. It's important to steer from the front on a real windy. Those real windy switchbacks. If you're steering from the front, you're saving a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
You're not ramming into the turn because you can't turn so sharp.
It's a lot of coordinating, and it feels really good when you ace the turns. Like, it becomes a sport in these real windy rivers.
We're drifting around these turns.
It's just so constant hairpins and these little things.
Sometimes
you do it, and you'd be like, yeah, that felt good. You conserved all your speed around that turn.
Definitely on the Birch River, we were going upstream, too. It's like,
it felt good when you
hit
them right.
When you come out of an upstream turn with momentum, feels great.
And Kyle and I are both big paddlers, but neither of us is a technical guy. Like, we've never studied paddling or think.
The most we've ever watched is that one guy.
We've seen the path of the paddle, but I'm not a guy who studied the thing. I've got a really goofy paddling stroke and such, I'm sure, you know, like, but mm-hmm. I've just paddled a lot.
Yeah.
So it's just fun for us to look. We don't know how to river paddle, but we were getting it right. It was starting to feel good to master a new thing.
And after probably a week, I was like, Brian, do you want to sit in the bow?
Yeah, because we were alternating every day, and
I was like, well, I kind of like the bow, and then he's just like, well, why aren't we just doing that? Because we were switching up every day.
And we're
day.
So much faster because I...
Trying to be fair.
I'm so used to being behind a guy, so like, if I don't see somebody paddling in front of me, I sometimes just stop paddling.
Yeah, I just crank out 10 miles without stopping and just have Brian try to keep up just to get him to paddle some more. Yeah.
Well, but our daily routine, though, it's all about, just like at camp, miles before lunch is important. So if you get your 25 miles in before your lunch.
Which is bonkers, by the way.
Which is pretty crazy. Which is
we'll
we hit most
10
of the time.
Five, yeah, okay.
So you, well,
on rivers.
On river, obviously.
Yeah.
But at camp, the equivalent to me is like, if you hit a double digit 10 miles before lunch, like, pat yourselves on the back. Especially because breaking camp before 10 a.m. on a Camp Voyager trip is very hard to do, even with the older kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were always out by 7:30, 8 o'clock. So, mm-hmm. Usually get 25 miles before lunch. Then after lunch, you go for like an hour or so hard. But then we would just like, all right, we would go
benches up,
and we'd flip up our chairs.
We
had our Bimbler chairs that we'd flip up. So we'd flip up our Crazy Creek chairs, and we'd lean back, and then we would
put
our feet up, and just lily dip for
paddle away
the next couple
more
hours
miles
as on a full like nobody's allowed to try hard. And I'd yell at Kyle every time he showed off,
like, stop,
we're lily dipping, stop it, we're benches up, quit it. And that was kind of the routine, and it worked really good. Mm-hmm. I mean,
we'd always stop around 10 o'clock for some snacks, and then...
Yep, yeah.
I don't know, around
because oatmeal's gone by 10. Oatmeal, they don't last.
Yeah. It doesn't. Yeah, and then lunch around 10, we'd stop somewhere, have some lunch, and then keep going.
Yeah. Open our can of baked beans, split it halfway, dump some crunchies in there, and move on. Mm-hmm.
Crunchies as in Cheez-Its, Goldfish,
or anything. Dry ramen noodles.
Anything with a crunch really adds to beans.
Baked beans,
and,
though.
Kind of weird.
Plain baked beans with a crunch.
Plain baked beans, opened right from the
cans on a trip was new, because, you know, Boundary Waters, you can't bring metal or glass. We could just buy cans of beans at the stores on the way and just eat beans the entire time.
Oh, God.
Dude,
it was dinner.
What did we have? We had a lot of beans and rice.
Rice and beans.
We had some pasta here and there, and
so
then
you just had oatmeal and
we
beans
had
for
two meals.
Days.
We had stuffing and mashed potatoes.
We stopped at Subway in Floodwood. I got footlong BLT.
Which is more like a 10-inch these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I imagine I don't let them get away with it. It's got.
Did it fill you up?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, I got. So we ate out a couple times because you're passing through towns. One of the more clutch moves was
the town of Palisade. We'll get to Brainerd.
Nice little town north of Brainerd. Our first night on the Mississippi, right?
Palisade? Yes, because off Big Sandy, 20 miles to Palisade.
Yeah, so Palisade's a little river town there, really pretty, like just a campground right down right in the middle of their town, basically, right by the river. Mm-hmm. And with hot showers and hot stuff. Hot showers. It's really,
you got electricity
really nice.
Posts here and there.
I remember when I passed that one on the Mississippi trip, I passed it around noon and I had to keep going to the next campsite. I was like, I really wish I was staying here.
Yeah.
You got to get electricity and hot showers. So that was good. But then was Kyle what was going to run a couple miles up.
Gotta get some more beans.
There's a gas station up the road.
But then at the gas station, I saw they had ice cream. So I got two cones and I ran them back to our campsite.
So I'm just hanging out at the campsite writing the journal entry and I see this guy, Kyle, running. I'm like, why is he running so fast? And he's holding something. He comes running with ice cream
dripping
over his
head. Down my hands. I'm like, Brian, have some ice cream.
And I've never been prouder of the young man.
I remember seeing that picture, like, wow,
this blueberry waffle cone and Barrett's Bounty ice cream.
That's the kind of traveling partner you need on these kind of expeditions.
Yeah.
A young guy whose knees don't hurt that's willing to go the extra mile to town bring back ice cream at a jogging pace.
Uh-huh.
It was very good. And that was my breakfast the next morning, was my melted leftover ice cream.
Gross.
I was going to eat it, but
I threw it out.
I don't know why. Yeah, he ate like half of it and then just like stared at it.
I was
and
so
then just
tired
forgot
that night.
It's funny.
Definitely went to bed pretty tired a few of the night.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of crashes. And then we stopped in Brainerd. That was the other clutch move. We were going so fast, we were going a little ahead of our schedule that we thought. We were like, oh, about 20, 21 days, we have this river paddling out the whole trip. We did an 18. So we actually stopped in Brainerd for a layover day.
No, Brainerd, that morning, we stopped in Brainerd, we still did 30
miles. Oh, yeah, we did 30 miles.
Before. We still did 34 miles before Brainerd.
But we stopped. But then we stopped, we got a taxi ride over to a hotel. We got
to Brainerd about
showers.
So we landed under the first
we got
big
hot
road.
Tub.
Got there a little before 4 o'clock.
Yeah, a little before 4. Showers, hot tub, comfy beds. We did a little laundry the next
morning.
So Kyle
insisted that we had to get one with a pool and a hot tub.
Yeah,
so
I would not stop
for
a hotel.
We had to go a little further.
No,
we had to go to Baxter. So we had to get a taxi over there. It was too far.
It's like a $15 taxi ride. It was fine.
It was very clutch. So next
did I see a picture of you falling asleep in the hot tub?
No.
Well, you were just your eyes closed listening.
I was at peace. Yeah,
it felt so good with those jets on your back after that Savannah portage.
It was great.
And yeah, we were
tough to leave in the morning.
Yeah.
Oh well, yeah. Well, we stayed till checkout.
We stayed till 11 o'clock checkout. And we were.
Kyle's a pretty big rule follower, so it was like 11:02. He's really mad at me for not being out of the room yet. But
I was like, all right, I'm gonna go down to the lobby. You ready?
He's still like, I'm already calling the taxi. You gotta go. But yes, we stayed the whole till 11 the next day. But
we had Rafferty's the night before. We ordered pizza, of course, to the room.
Of course. And then basically, we took a hot tub, turned on the TV, but I think I still passed out by 8.
Dude, the TV. We watched the rodeo show for a while.
Like we were watching
rodeo. We learned a lot about rodeo.
And then just fell asleep early, though, and slept really good. Continental breakfast in the morning.
Continental?
We really screwed up by not stocking up on a few more, like...
We should have grabbed some more of that bread.
Yeah, they had, like, individually wrapped things of bread and things with peanut butter.
Muffins, peanut butter.
So we kind of screwed that up, but I brought a couple donuts with.
Good biscuits and gravy in the morning and some fruit.
And back to the trail.
And then back to the trail.
Taxi ride back to... Where are you dropping us off? I guess that bridge kind of by the Ace Hardware.
Second in Washington, I think.
And then he drops you off, and then you watch the guy's kind of puzzled look as you walk down the
riverbank.
Hike down the steep bank to where you stashed your boat. We would bike lock it to a tree with the with the food pack. You know, the stuff we didn't need, just lock it all together. And
then we decided to do a pretty short day. We did 12 miles, and then we stopped at a site. Where did we stop at?
We stopped at Crow Wing State Park, which is actually the other cool thing, historical.
Ooh, Crow Wing.
So,
there's
the town of Crow Wing,
Kyle. There's an old town site at Crow Wing. It's the confluence of the Crow Wing River and Mississippi, and it's where the old Red River Trail was blazed for the Forest Trail? Middle Trail? What was it called?
The big ox trails, basically, that go up the Red River Valley.
This is where they forged across the river for this big ox trail up to Winnipeg, basically.
So, like, through Fargo up towards Winnipeg.
So, from Minneapolis up to St. Cloud, cut over to Crow Wing, and then keep going up towards Winnipeg.
And Crow Wing was the first sizable
European
settlement in central Minnesota.
And this was back in, what,
1856,
I think, is when it was the biggest?
But, like, by 1880, like, the whole settlement was gone.
It was a very
really quick boom.
Because then, what was it, Brainerd had a train bridge go across, and then they stopped being a fording place.
But there's a massive island, which is where the name Crow Wing comes from. It's shaped like a big crow's wing, kind of, where the Crow Wing River kind of splits as it comes into the Mississippi. or yeah, it's got yep. it kind of yep. forms this big giant There's, island in the middle with yep. kind of a couple channels in it,
but and it's shaped like a crow wing.
Yeah, and but that was a very notable place that a lot of natives. It was never like a full time like a town or anything, but mm-hmm. a lot of natives would camp there at certain times of the year, and very then they would trade spot. With this. You know, established town right across the river there.
Warehouses for trading.
So there was a lot of trading happening and, yeah. and business happening. But it was, so it was a real town. Big boom town at the
they
time.
They had hotels, saloons, and all and they, sorts of buildings.
They've
they
recreated the boardwalk where the old boardwalk was in the town, mm-hmm. and the roads are still there.
Yep.
But lot really well researched, a lot of good interpretive signs. There was a really dedicated dude. I don't remember what
just
it was.
The like park maintenance staff.
Yeah, the dedicated dude like in the 1950s or something that had gone back and done this research for a lot of what we know about this place. It was kind of one guy did a lot of it, but really well signed. Great state park. I'd been there once as a kid. I didn't really remember it. But
we got there pretty early, so we just took off and walked around this place for a lot the rest of the evening.
Because we only had a 12-mile day that day, so we had left. You know, we got on the river a little before noon, and
we got there, around there by 2:30 maybe. So
basically it was a nice day off for us.
I think I walked the entire state park.
Yeah, Kyle went off for a really long walk.
Yeah.
And it goes long.
But it's not that big, but there's so much history in that area.
It neat cool. stuff. Like literally there's like these pits that there's right this, down there's, from this, our campsite. There's an oral history from the late 1800s of a group of Dakota Indians traveling up from south of the Twin Cities area through the Mississippi in a raiding party to attack and enslave a group of the people right up basically camp right at Crow Wing or it was north of Crow Wing, right? And so basically then they knew, so they had attacked this village and captured a bunch of women and slaves, and they were traveling back down the Mississippi, and they knew that they would have to pass this point, so they doubled ahead, beat them down the Crow Wing River and waited at the confluence,
so
and
had dug
these pits, which they call them Indian rifle pits, and they waited for them in these pits, and you could see it's a long sight line there, and they waited for this group of the Dakota Indians coming back down towards Minneapolis area with these women that they captured, and they killed all of them and rescued all the women and stuff, and it's this big story that this happened there. The pits are right there.
If those are clearly see
them, they're definitely pits that were dug by people, but they're not sure, is that the actual rifle pits from the story, or maybe it's just like a borrowing pit, you know, where you would dig up the dirt next to the road for the road that's right there.
Yeah.
But the pits are there, clearly dug by humans in the late 1800s, mm-hmm. when they're really, you know, not much of the settlement at that point. But
yeah.
It's really interesting. There's lots of cool stories on these signs.
Yeah, that was crowing. And then right across the river was Fort Ripley, or Camp Ripley. So a big military area.
All night long.
Boom! Just big shell booms. I call them shell booms.
Yeah. Kyle doesn't fully understand military and artillery. It's like, man, that's a lot of shell booms.
A lot of shell booms going on. The state park had like signs up warning you, like, by the way, Camp Ripley is doing, I think they said, shell training.
Well, they basically the big Ripley artillery ranges. There's a couple of them that are all just kind of along the river there.
So throughout the evening, you'd hear booms traveling across this area. Camp Ripley.
Yeah, that weekend there we're doing a lot of
and
artillery.
Before in Brainerd, we were hearing these things as we were paddling.
Yeah, we kept wondering about this weird thunder we saw because it was completely
construction.
Clear.
Is it thunder? There's no way it's thunder. And we got up there, I'm like, oh.
And it made you feel uneasy, like they were, because it was also close. In a few different places, because there's multiple ranges, I guess, in there. So as you traveled on the river, you'd hear further up and some more, you know, like tank fire sound, you know, artillery some sort, but. Big explosions. And like, it makes you feel uneasy, like we're in a war somehow. And just like that, it was very bizarre. Yeah. And you know, went on for 2 days of the trip.
Yeah, it did.
Kyle tried for a while to get one out. We have a funny video of us trying to capture it. 3 minutes. There's no way to capture the sound, you know.
Trying to get one.
Sometimes it's happening 4 times in a minute, and then sometimes it goes away for a couple
of minutes.
So
you record for 2 minutes, and then you turn it off, and then 10 seconds later, a big boom goes off. Like, I missed it.
Yeah, but it was very eerie. Yeah, it's hard to explain. It was an odd. Yeah. Odd. You felt small.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, we've just rambling been at long. This point.
No, it's all good. Thanks for saving your stories.
Yeah.
I wanted to do this when you guys first got here, but I made you hold them in until I could catch them.
There's always more. There's still more. There's always more.
We might have to do this again.
Well, I think for sure we got to do another future podcast about some of the wintergreen stuff.
Yeah,
because we've built in the last few years. There's been a lot of these Wintergreen Camp Voyager crossover. We've been building a big alliance here, and actually, the Alliance of Wintergreen goes back to Charlie Erdman. So I don't know if you know much about Alex the Farm Lake Teepee. Does that phrase mean much to you?
No.
And I'd be curious of any alumni or anybody who might be aware I've never seen a photo. I really want to see a photo. But apparently there's a really cool structure down on the...
It's on the North Kuish, right across from the point here.
Okay.
Tucked into the woods on the left. That's where it was. That's what Paul said.
So just up the North Kuish. Yeah, so not far from like where Ralph placed it on that island was. That way?
Ralph placed it. Where was he?
This island kind of at the... Where you pass to go to the Boundary Waters on the North Kuish.
Yeah, you go across towards Battleship.
Yeah, that one big island there, where all the houses... There's like multiple houses.
That's a point. No. Yeah, that's where the teepee was, I believe. That's
just past that. On.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So but
Paul had that as a place.
So, well, he was in on that with a group of other people. This mm-hmm. is back... So Paul... And there's someone connects with Deb here, too. So Paul actually started this wilderness inquiry. So this was back when they were first trying to develop the Boundary Waters into this wilderness thing. People were... The argument was is that they had to still allow motors and motorized portages in more of the Boundary Waters to allow for handicapped people to be able to access more of the Boundary Waters, was the argument that they were putting out, the resorts were putting out and stuff like that. And Paul's response to this as a guy just out of college was, you know, well, I want to get paid to go camping in the Boundary Waters. So he was like, I will take... So he started this whole company where they would take people with really profound disabilities, like, you know, quadriplegic folks, and then, you know, anybody who wanted to go on a wilderness trip, he'd take you and take you the most impressive, intense trips. And they would do this with people with profound needs, you know, portaging, all that stuff. But Deb, I know, as part of her program in school, for her master's degree, she did some work with them, and she went out and guided a few trips with them too, and like cared for a quadriplegic person on this trip and guided. So Deb's guided with them a little bit too. But so Charlie and Paul were friends as well. And so when they had this teepee structure over on Farm Lake here, Wilderness Inquiry used it, and they had a couple other groups.
Like a winter base, right?
Yeah, it was kind of, I guess, a structure that was, you could camp in the winter, and it was just like a permanent, semi-permanent structure. It eventually burned down is what happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of weird, mysterious circumstances on that. It's kind of weird. But anyway... But Charlie, though, and Paul did know each other. Camp was the access point for that. So he allowed them to launch their boats from camp. So mm-hmm. young Paul Shirky, prior to his North Pole days and, you know, being on the cover of National Geographic, was friends with Charlie Erdman, and they would come launch to camp to go over there. So that's where the connections with Wintergreen Dogs had allowed to kind of start there. But now we've got our chef Goose is from mm-hmm. there, and mm-hmm. he brought Meavers over there, and now Kyle's here, and we've got Sam here, and... The last couple of years, we've been bringing the kids over to visit the dogs mm-hmm. in the summer. Mm-hmm. It's been very well received and popular by both the kids and the dogs. The people I care most about in the world are the Camp Voyager kids and the dogs, and it's fun to watch them come together. mm-hmm. They're kind of an equivalent in mine and Kyle's minds a little bit in our seasons. We sit around and talk about the campers at night during the summer the same way we'd sit around and talk about the dogs and their personalities.
Yeah, I heard you guys talk about the dogs.
And you heard us talk about the kids. Yeah. Yep. And, you know, you're kind of proud of them in a lot of the same ways, and it's fun to watch them grow in a lot of the same ways. And they both frustrate you and delight you in a lot of the same ways.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well,
Do you have any more questions about our trip?
I think Aaron is going to start Napoleon Dynamite down there soon.
Dynamite. I think we're actually Robinson Crusoe, the black and white version.
Oh, yeah.
Circa, what's the year on that?
1940-something, I think.
Well, good thing we still got that print that Mim ordered that one time, right?
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Well, thanks again, you guys.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We'll have to do a part two one of these days, or talk about our Wintergreen Camp Voyager Alliance.
Yeah, we got to form it, make it stronger. Mm-hmm. We got to bring back. I think we got to bring back the Camp Voyager winter trip.
That would be cool. Winter break. Well,
Alex immediately is going to edit that part.